Hello, you're listening to the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I'm your other host, Ankit Panda, also in Washington. Good to be with you, Katie.
Good to be with you, Ankit. And today we are joined by a very special guest, the diplomat's editor-in-chief and resident China expert, Shannon Tiezi. She's going to help us unpack Russian President Vladimir Putin's two-day visit to China on May 16, 17th, I believe it was. Welcome back to the podcast, Shannon.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to join you guys.
We are so excited to have you here because we think and are certain you will have things to tell us about this visit. Putin's recent visit to China was actually his first trip abroad following his fifth inauguration as Russian president earlier in May. The surface reason for the visit was to honor the 75th anniversary of the Soviet Union's recognition of the People's Republic of China. But not far under that surface were the churning waters of geopolitics, which concern us here on the podcast. You know, it's not hard to put the visit in the context of the Russian war in Ukraine and this era of difficult relations between China and the United States. But I think, Shannon, we should start with the visit and sort of move towards the bigger picture of China-Russia relations. Were there any major items on the agenda or outcomes from this visit that we should pay attention to?
Sure. For a visit that was supposed to celebrate, as you said, the 75th anniversary of China-Russia ties, and China always loves to make a big deal of these anniversary years, I thought this visit was surprisingly subdued. There were no major headline announcements. They did sign some deals, but there were no big breakthroughs. There's no major upgrade to the relationship, which is especially interesting given that Xi Jinping was just in Europe the week before he hosted Putin, and we saw much fanfare in upgrade to China-Serbia relations and an upgrade to China-Hungary relations. China-Russia relations is just chugging along. It's chugging along at a very high level. They repeated the formula that it's at the best level in history, but it doesn't really seem to be expanding, at least not rapidly. And I think interestingly, the no limits formula that everyone still talks about has disappeared, which suggests that either China discovered, wait, there are limits to our cooperation, or they no longer want to advertise that there are no longer limits to China-Russia relationship. So yeah, that appeared just prior to the Ukraine war and then has never been mentioned since. So I think Beijing might have had a little bit of buyer's remorse there, despite all of the progress that we've seen in China-Russian relations. Beijing doesn't want to advertise quite in such an in-your-face overt manner how close its ties are to Russia, particularly having just talked with leaders in Europe about all of the concerns that they have about that relationship.
So, Shannon, do you think the post-Sunnyside talk of a U.S.-China detente, do you think that was a little overwrought, just given what we've seen, I guess, about the joint Putin-Xi kind of expression of grievances towards the United States in the course of this summit? How do we reconcile that? I mean, are the people talking about a detente in U.S.-China relations just wrong about that? Or are we kind of seeing China compartmentalize how it talks to Russia about the United States versus how it talks to the United States about the United States?
I think what we're seeing, and to some extent still are seeing in China-US relations, is a decision to tone down the rhetoric more than the substance. There was never any progress on the major structural issues in the relationship. You know, China didn't suddenly agree to renounce the use of force against Taiwan. It's obviously still being very assertive slash aggressive, depending on who you act, towards a U.S. ally, the Philippines in the South China Sea. And then, of course, this perennial issue of China's support to Russia, including literal material support that could be going to the war in Ukraine, has not gone away. China has indicated it has no intention of halting or downgrading its trade of these dual-use items with Russia. So I think detente was an overblown way to describe what happened. It was more an agreement to tone down what we might call the wolf warrior diplomacy, to hold more regular meetings and discussions. And there's been some progress on, you know, very specific issues like the working group on AI global governance that just met. There's been a working group on opioids and fentanyl production that has met a few times. But yeah, I don't think anyone who studies the U.S.-China relationship thought that the meeting between Biden and Xi last year was a huge breakthrough and a game changer for the direction of the relationship. It was very reassuring in the sense that you feel there's less likelihood for a single flashpoint issue to just suddenly spark this conflagration because there's more communication. They're trying to add guardrails, which is what the Biden administration, the language they often use about it, but they're not really slowing down the driving speed, to continue this highway guardrails metaphor. They're not changing the direction that they're driving. They're just trying to do what they're already doing a little more safely. And I think that's how you can reconcile what we've seen, you know, in terms of US officials going to China at a fairly regular clip, but then also no meaningful change in how China is approaching Russia or any major global issues.
Yeah, Shannon, because U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was recently in China also. How do you sort of compare and contrast the two visits? Obviously, they're at different levels, you know, a Secretary of State foreign minister level versus a presidential level. But how do you think that impacted some of the conversations that might have happened?
Yeah, I think you can draw a fairly direct through line. And this is partially the Biden administration's own doing. They made it very clear before Blinken went to China that one of his major agenda items was talking to China about these dual use exports to Russia and really hammering home the point, like, the US is going to consider sanctioning Chinese companies over this issue. This is a major point. And what we saw while Blinken was in China was that China was not willing to budge on that. And that really got emphasized with Putin. And obviously the tones of the visit were quite different. Putin's reception is much warmer, as you mentioned, it's higher level, but the state media coverage and all of the fanfare with it, it's just a very celebratory tone. This is not just a business as usual meeting. People often talk about the Putin-Xi bromance. And certainly they at least want to give the appearance that there is warm personal affection between the two leaders in a way that when US officials are hosted, it's very businesslike and you don't quite have the same level of camaraderie. But yes, it was very interesting having just had Blinken in China and having just had Xi hear some of the same discussions, particularly in his conversations with President Macron in France, about concerns over this sort of trade with Russia, that the China-Russia joint statement doubles down on how they're going to cooperate on cutting edge technology in a variety of fields. So it's very clear that if that was Blinken's goal, he did not make much progress.
So going back for a second to, I guess, the nuts and bolts on the deliverables from the Putin-Xi meeting. So, you know, we got another extremely long joint statement, right? 7,000 words. I mean, just a laundry list of everything each country cares about. It was sort of like, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So, you know, the Russians express their support for China's view on Taiwan, the Chinese express their support for Russia's view on Ukraine, so on and so forth. And then you have sort of the common grievances about the United States. So, you know, Shannon, you've already said a little bit about some of the changes from the February 4th, 2022 statement, but did anything else kind of jump out to you in sort of this extremely detailed and lengthy joint statement?
Yeah, so on your point about them supporting each other, one thing that I found very interesting is you get a lot more of Russia explicitly saying Russia supports China on this laundry list of issues. So there's agreement on issues mostly in the Asia Pacific, obviously what the US would call the Indo-Pacific, but they adopt the Asia Pacific terminology, about opposing the deployment of short-range missiles near China and Russia, firm opposition to AUKUS, you know, supporting China in the South China Sea. If you look at this section on Ukraine, China's not saying it doesn't support Russia, but there's no bullet point that says China supports Russia. Actually, there's two bullet points with Russia talking about how how much it is a fan of China's position on Ukraine.
Positively assesses China's objective and unbiased position. Yeah, that jumped out to me too. It was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. China is not actually saying explicitly that it supports Russia's position on Ukraine. Now, there is earlier in the joint statement a remark that they firmly support each other on issues of territorial sovereignty and integrity, which of course you could take to include Russia's concerns about Ukraine. You could also read it as Russia supporting China over Taiwan. It could be both. But yeah, I think China, again, is kind of very artfully keeping this plausible deniability that it's always adopted toward Ukraine. It's saying everything except explicitly affirming its support to Russia, whereas Russia is really going out of its way to directly state it supports China on issues that really have no direct bearing on Russia, such as the South China Sea, which is fascinating given Russia's historical relationship with Vietnam, which is one of China's main rival claimants in the South China Sea. I think it's also interesting, as I said, no limits seems to have disappeared despite the media and even my own continued obsession with it. It's kind of become shorthand for how close the relationship is. They're not talking about it anymore at the official level. And it seems that they've settled on a new formula, which is that China-Russia relations are not temporary and are not opportunistic, which I think is supposed to convey the same meaning, which is our partnership is enduring. This is not just a marriage of convenience. We're in it for the long haul, but it's different language. And this also allows China to sort of distance itself. Like, we're not just getting closer to Russia because of Ukraine, guys. This isn't opportunistic. This is a strategic partnership. So those were the main things that I thought were interesting. Of course, there's a lot of language that's being repeated from the two statements and carried over. But as I said, there are no huge breakthroughs or expansions that we saw this time either.
So I kind of want to take us back to the Ukraine question for a second, because I do think it's really interesting how, you know, Russia is very specific about supporting China on certain parts, and China is less specific about what it means by it sort of supporting Russia. So how would you characterize the Chinese position on Ukraine? And what is that in contrast to what the Chinese say their position on Ukraine is?
So officially, the Chinese position is that they are neutral. They support peace. And what that means in practice is they are against arms sales to Ukraine. They haven't specifically come out and condemned North Korea for providing arms to Russia, which if they were, 100% neutral, you would think that they would, because they have explicitly stated that when the U.S. or European countries are providing arms to Ukraine, this is simply adding fuel to the fire. Everybody needs to stop doing that. Just, remain calm, de-escalate, and have peace talks. This is the sort of nebulous, really inactionable language that China has adopted to talk about global hotspot issues, including the current crisis in Gaza. It's really a way for China to pretend that it's taking a stance and being a major global player on these issues without actually having to do all of that much. And we've seen this from China's special envoy on the Ukraine issue, Li Hui. He's taken three shuttle diplomacy trips now, and they've all really been giant nothing burgers. The Europeans talk to him because they don't want to be rude enough to refuse to speak to him, but nobody expects there to be any breakthrough. Nobody considers that China is actually doing any serious mediating between the European side and Russia, because just the trust isn't there. Mm-hmm. They just don't believe that China actually cares at all about Ukraine's interest in this conflict, despite some rhetorical hinting about the importance of territorial integrity and sovereignty and these very basic principles that, you know, Russia has pretty flagrantly violated in the Ukraine conflict. But I don't think anyone really believes that China takes those seriously, Russia included. And so that's where you have this, okay, China is on Russia's side, but no one can actually find the smoking gun, where Xi Jinping has come out and said, you know, great job for invading Ukraine, Putin, because they are very careful about the way they talk about the conflict.
Well, one more question for you, Shannon, before we let you go. You know, when you have sort of two world leaders of the caliber of Putin and Xi, I think there's always sort of a question of which is on top, which one is more powerful. And it certainly suggests to me in the way that that joint statement is worded, with Russia making more concrete commitments and China making more, as you called them, nebulous ones. You know, what is your take on that? You know, which power sort of needs the other a little bit more? I think I know the answer, but I'm curious your take on sort of what is that sort of positioning. You know, these are often, they talk about each other as being of equal sort of strength and value, but it seems very much that power relationship is very unbalanced, certainly after the war in Ukraine and arguably before. But I'm curious on your sort of take on that kind of positionality question.
Yeah. So this is a case where I tend to agree with the general wisdom that you will find in foreign policy analysis writ large, which is that China is on the ascent while Russia is kind of trending downward in terms of its global stature. And there are some interesting points specifically in the joint statement from this visit that you can take to kind of make sense of this dynamic. One thing is, there's a lot of talk about China and Russia coordinating on the global stage to promote multilateralism and oppose hegemony. And you know, translation from the diplomatic language that they're using is that means to oppose the US global leadership and promote alternatives, you know, the expansion of BRICS and the SCO. What's interesting is that if you really parse the joint statement, there's a number of examples of Russia specifically saying it supports China's global initiatives. There's no such statements from China saying we support Russia's global governance initiatives, and it's because they don't really exist, right? It's like, China is the one saying, we have a global security initiative, we have the Belt and Road Initiative, we have the Global Development Initiative, and now they have their Global Governance Initiative for Artificial Intelligence, and there's just, they go on and on. Russia's not offering that up. It's really China who's in the driver's seat in terms of coming up with an alternative to the US world order. And this is a dynamic that many other analysts have pointed to as well, which is that Russia really can offer disruption. It can chip away at the US global order, but if you're looking for another global order to take shape, China is the one who's actually starting to do that. So in that sense, Russia is really just hanging on to China's coattails. And I think there's also an interesting dynamic of Russia really trying to cling to this era where it was, you know, one of the two global superpowers. And it leads to things like, you know, Russia talking about how much it wants to cooperate with China. You know, oh, we're going to jointly advance our space program, we're going to jointly advance electric vehicle technology and microprocessors and things like that, when everybody knows that China is actually a major global leader in these technologies, and Russia is not. And China is not all that interested in cooperating with Russia on electric vehicles because Russia doesn't have much to offer. And the same for semiconductors, you know, where Russia would really, really like to be self-sufficient in semiconductors amid all of the sanctions. China is really focused on being self-sufficient in semiconductors, and they kind of know that Russia is not going to help them in that endeavor. So they would rather turn to other partners. China is more interested in, yeah, keep sending us energy and raw materials and agricultural goods. And the dynamic in the trade aspect of the relationship is growing closer to, you know, the dynamic that China has with some of its partners in Latin America or Africa, you know, and Russia doesn't want to be Brazil, you know, they don't want to be Nigeria. They think of themselves as Russia. We're a great power. We should be on par with China in terms of cutting edge technology and things like that. They're just not able to. And when people talk about the inherent friction in China not wanting to be the little brother, I think that's what they're talking to. But I also think that Russia has kind of found a way to just live comfortably in denial by talking about these things as though they're happening. And China's perfectly willing to include a line in the joint statement about how it's going to collaborate with Russia on electric vehicles. You know, it doesn't hurt them. Are they actually going to, you know, set up major joint ventures where Russia is producing this technology for them? No. And so they're just both willing to say these things so that Russia can save face. But behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Russia very much taking that sort of junior partner status in the relationship with China.
All right. Well, Shannon, I think we'll leave it there for today. But thank you so much for talking through this summit and for really kind of drawing attention to some of those really small details that I think a lot of people can miss. It's always good to have you on.
Well, yep. Thanks you guys for having me on and for letting me parse the arcane diplomatic language in the joint statement. I do think that it's important, and hopefully the listeners enjoyed seeing some of those granular details really drawn out.
That's right. And Katie, before we close out, I wanted to maybe turn it to you to tell our listeners a little bit about the upcoming issue of The Diplomat's Magazine.
Give me 1 second, because if it's not in front of me, I forget about it.
Don't worry about it. I put you on the spot. I'm already going to be editing, so it's not a big deal.
It's amazing how I can spend so much time planning something and then forget entirely what is in it.
We've all been there.
All right. So yes, so the upcoming issue of the magazine is very exciting. Our cover story is going to be focused on Papua New Guinea and its position in the geopolitical churn that's taking place in the Pacific. We've also got a really great piece of analysis focused on Pakistan's new government and the you know, eternal tension between the civilian side and the military side, and why that is such an impediment to real progress, particularly on the economic issues. We have another piece focused on non-proliferation in the Pacific, specifically the treaty that's focused on banning nuclear weapons, and some of the countries that are have vested interests in not having nuclear weapons, such as Marshall Islands and Japan, but nonetheless, because of some of their connections to the United States, are not signing on to these treaties. And then there's a whole bunch more. Shannon has a really excellent analysis of China's many levels of partnerships. We talked about No Limits a little bit, but there are other levels of partnerships that she dives into in a really, really excellent piece, and so much more. So if you are not a subscriber to the magazine, please check it out. I think it would be a valuable read for everyone who enjoys this podcast.
Thanks, Katie. I think that ends the episode for today. Make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber but you haven't yet left us a review, please do that. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. It really helps the show. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.